This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, has written a new book about his experiences adopting two children from China and how his daughters have changed his life. He and his wife, Caroline, first tried to have children in what Scott describes as the traditional Abraham begat Sarah manner, as well as through in vitro fertilization. The latest innovations in fertility treatment are pretty amazing, but it's adoption that Scott describes as a miracle. His oldest daughter, Elise, is now 7. He and Caroline adopted their younger daughter, Lena, after 3 years after Elise. In Scott's book, he also writes about the experiences of friends and colleagues who have adopted children or who are themselves adopted. In addition to hosting Weekend Edition, Scott spent years reporting for NPR from war zones. His new book is called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in Praise of Adoption. Scott Simon, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
Because you write so well, I thought we would start with a reading from your book. So would you do a short reading for us?
Sure. Well, this is the part when our oldest daughter was put into our arms, our oldest daughter, Elise, who had the Chinese name Feng Xiaomei. And we were at the adoption center in central Nancheng, which is in southern China. Grinning bureaucrats received us and showed us to a staircase. They took us down a flight and into a room. We saw smiling middle-aged women in white smocks holding babies, cooing, singing, and hefting them in their arms. We shucked raindrops from our shoes and coats. We checked cameras and cell phones. We looked at the women in the smocks and then realized they held our children in their arms. We saw Elise. She was 5 months older than in the picture we had, but still, recognizably, the little girl in the thumbnail portrait. Pouty little mouth, tiny endearing little downy baby duck's head, fuzzy patch of hair, and amazed eyebrows, crying, steaming, red-faced, and bundled into a small, puffy pink coat. We blinked back tears and cleared our throats. And I go on to explain that we brought her back to our hotel room, and she cried. She was inconsolable, despite my wife's best efforts to coo and comfort her and my clownish efforts to try and amuse her. And finally, our trip coordinator, who'd been through this many times before, said, well, you know, you should all go downstairs and get something to eat. I don't remember what we ate, not much of whatever it was. I had a glass of wine, my wife had a beer, and we toasted our daughter. The drinks flashed through us like tap water. We ate and talked and tried to amuse, divert, and win over our daughter with songs, food, and funny voices, leaving her sullen and unmoved, all the while asking ourselves, what have we done? What were we thinking? We ripped a baby away from the only place she's ever known to bring her someplace on the other side of the world that might as well be the moon. What kind of people are we? Then Caroline and I realized that in the space of an afternoon, our lives had suddenly developed a few new and indisputable truths. That my wife and I loved each other even more than we had a few hours ago. That we loved no one on earth more than this new, small, squalling, hungry, thirsty, and occasionally ornery human being that was now ours. Our baby had opened new chambers in our hearts, and we realized our daughter hated us.
Scott Simon reading from his new memoir, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in Praise of Adoption. So how long did it take until you felt your daughter didn't see you as the enemy?
Oh, 2 or 3 days. It got a little better every day. I mean, we weren't the enemy. We were feeding her. We were holding her. We bathed her. She just didn't become happy about it for another couple of days. And, you know, looking back on it, the transition is very quick. It was, of course, she immediately became our child, and our identity with her deepened every day and deepens every day even now. And I'd say that happens with our daughters, too. But the initial reaction is there's no Hallmark card moment when your little girl is put into your arms under the circumstances, because the only world they've known is behind them. And the idea of another change just when they were getting comfortable in a world they knew in an orphanage, the idea of change is obviously obnoxious. And it takes a few days, but you know, only a few days, 72 hours, it's nothing in a lifetime.
How could you tell during those first couple of days what was the difference between just ordinary baby crying and baby being torn away from the only home they've ever known, given to strangers, crying?
Well, I should underscore that since I'd never been a parent before, I'm sure my perception is purely amateurish. And a lot of it just might be sheer projection on my part. But she was utterly inconsolable. And, of course, she didn't know us. I mean, we smelled funny. We looked funny. We were out of a different world. I think my best efforts to kind of amuse her, well, they fell flat with a lot of people, don't they? But they certainly fell flat with her in the first few hours. And I don't mean to project too much, but I come back to the fact that she had already, Elise was then 11 months old. When we got Lena, she was 7 months old. By the time we got them, they had already seen an awful lot of history. They had already been, a term I don't like because it seems harsh, but they'd already been abandoned by scared young mothers. I think something they're not totally unaware of under the circumstances. They had connected perhaps with other people in an orphanage, however imperfect the care there can be. And suddenly you have a couple of adults who are all over them. You know, they move, they squall, and say, are you all right? Are you all right? They're not used to that kind of total attention.
You seem to have had two slightly different reactions when you adopted your daughters. For the oldest, it was this immediate sense of, that's her, she's ours. With your youngest, the first reaction was, is this the right one? She doesn't look like the photograph.
When we got our second daughter, Lena, which is short for Paulina, we had gotten a little photograph as we had for Elise. And we didn't go to an orphanage center, adoption center this time. They said, I think it was 4 o'clock, we'll knock on your hotel room door and bring your baby to you. And I said to my wife, my gosh, talk about room service. And they knocked on the door and they came into our suite and they set this little baby down on the kind of conference table there. And she did not look like the little girl in the picture. And my wife and I were, on the one hand, delighted and ecstatic. And on the other hand, it didn't look like the little girl in the picture. Now, we couldn't have cared less. But what we didn't want was them coming back in a couple of hours and say, oh, you know, there's been some terrible mistake. You got the baby that was meant for the Shmulevitz family, and they got yours. Let's make a switch right now. Because as soon as they brought that baby into the suite, we were falling in love with her. And I will never forget that our little girl, Elise, our oldest daughter, who herself had been cast aside in life, she just reached out with her little hand with a kind of tenderness you usually don't see in five-year-olds. And she just reached out to her sister and she said, it doesn't matter. And I have never loved a human being or a human moment more.
In adopting two daughters from China, you are very aware of the politics in China that lead to so many female children, so many baby girls being available for adoption. And I'd like you to describe...
A far smaller percentage are available for adoption than are abandoned. If you, if you take the figure of 15 million orphan and abandoned children in China, of which this would be a guess, but I think a pretty good one, that 14,750,000 are little girls, a couple thousand are adopted every year. It's a scintilla of the babies who could be adopted, obviously.
What stories did you hear about how women abandon their babies in such a way that they can hope that the babies will be taken care of?
Well, for one thing, it's illegal to bear a second child, which would obviously be the case with some mothers. It's also illegal to abandon a child. So we were told that what commonly happens is a scared young mother will take a train or otherwise get to a location that scores or even a couple hundred miles away from where they actually live, so they won't be identified. And they will wrap their baby in a blanket, put her in a basket, and put her in some very public place where she knows that baby will be found and taken to an adoption center, perhaps first a police station, then an adoption center. And typically, the young mother waits across the street or hides behind a tree to make certain that her baby is picked up. And I just cannot imagine the anxiety, and I think torture is the proper word, that a young mother must feel looking at her child across the street, traffic whizzing by, wondering, hoping, praying that she'll be picked up.
Scott, how old were each of your daughters when you adopted them?
Elise was 11 months old when she came into our life, and Lena was 7 months.
So you've tried to imagine what their lives were like in the orphanages before you adopted your daughters. And you write that you think your daughters were probably well-fed, but not always well attended to. What effect do you think that had on them emotionally and on their ability, you know, to cope with things in general?
Well, you know, it's not just my projection. I think we have the benefit of a lot of professional opinion on this at this particular point. The youngsters in orphanages are not fed when they're hungry. They're not necessarily, they don't hike a blanket up around their shoulders again when they're necessarily cold. And obviously, a lot of these institutions are unheated and have an incomplete heating. What happens is, because of the volume in which they're working, it has to be done according to a schedule. So kids cry out, and there are not people that run out to pick them up and love them and coo in their faces and cuddle them the way we think ought to be done with babies, the way I think they think in China even ought to be done with babies. The volume is just too great. And I think what happens is that orphanage kids, and I think, by the way, they develop great strengths too, but I think that they begin to feel a little bit, you know, they lose a little bit of that, lose a little bit of their childhood that way, in that they feel kind of unnaturally responsible for their own survival at a very early age. And I think a little bit of their childlike innocence is lost that way, and they become just a little bit hardened, accustomed to having to look out for themselves and put themselves across. Now, I also want to say that I think the people that we saw in the two orphanages that we saw are overworked and undoubtedly trying to do the best that they can. But it's the best that they can, and I think not the kind of lives we would want for any of our children.
Now, you were in your early 50s when you adopted?
I think it was 50.
50, okay. So what are some of the pros and cons of becoming a father relatively late in life?
You know, the only con that I can think of is that I'm just aware of the fact that I'm not going to be around for a lot. But, you know, as I say that, I have just delivered the eulogy at Dan Shore's funeral. My dear old friend, and he was even older when he became a father, and he was told the same thing, and he lived to the age of almost 94, and his kids are in their 40s, and he was around for a lot. So I that's the only con I can think of. I think I am a much better father now than I would have been when I was younger. And I think everybody who knows me would probably agree. Now, you can never tell how the presence of a child in your life will rally you and focus your mind and change your thinking, because I have, you know, observed that even now. But I don't really think of that as a drawback. I tell you something that it does affect, and it's not just – I mean, let's put it this way. Children – any daughters of mine will have a lot bigger impediments in life by being my daughters than my age presents. I mean, they're my daughters. Of course, they'll have some problems anyway, but I don't think my age is part of it. I do think when it came to having a second daughter, it sharpened my mind this way. And look, I was an only child myself, although I had a sister who died at an early age. But I think something that my wife and I confronted was, as any parent should, is that you understand, I think especially when you adopt, that as parents you're not going to be around forever. And it's certainly something that I feel keenly. And among the many other reasons why I think we wanted a second child, to kind of put the right amount of gravity on everybody in the family, it was certainly on my mind that at some point, I'm going to disappear. I'm going to leave the scene. Even my wife, as young as she is, isn't going to be around forever. And there's a lot to be said for having a running mate. For all our talk about friends and family in a loving circle, there's a lot to be said for having a sibling, to having a running mate, someone to join you in life, who shares those formative experiences, who shares, for that matter, the same set of parents, and someone that is profoundly attached to you in the way that siblings are.
In your book, you write that your daughters are taking classes learning Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
And also,
they haven't been this summer, but yes.
Okay. And they're learning how to cook certain Chinese dishes. They're observing certain Chinese holidays, probably in a class with other children who, like them, are adopted from China.
Yes, although I think the kid who speaks Mandarin best is Saul, and he's not adopted from anywhere. His family has adopted a child from China, and Saul is learning Mandarin too, and excellent at it, I gather.
Why did you want to send them to this school?
Well, you know, this is a...
it's extracurricular, I know that, yeah.
Yeah, it's been in hiatus this summer, and we'll reassess it. You know, we want our little girls to grow up with some consciousness, obviously, of their Chinese heritage, and we want to make this available to them. Now, I think they will go through different periods of their lives when, at some point, their Chinese ancestry and heritage is going to be very important to them. At other points, and I think we're at that point right now, it's not particularly important to them. We don't want to get hung up about it one way or another. We want to make it available to them. You know, you have to confront the fact that your children, the children you've adopted, are not just cultural vessels. They're living, breathing human beings who at some point will sort all of this out for themselves, and not all at once. They're going to grow up and make the decisions that they want to. You know, Caroline and I went through a period where she wanted all of our babysitters to be Chinese. And as a result, we weren't getting out much. And I said to her at one point, you know, we were scouting a three-state area for Chinese babysitters. I said to her at one point, darling, I think we should stop racially profiling our babysitters. But we did get a great babysitter, a wonderful woman named Dun Dun, who was from China. And it was worth all of the time and the effort because one night Elise said to Dun Dun, I said, what about your brothers and sisters? And she said, I don't have any brothers or sisters. And she said, you know, you're very lucky to have a sister because in China we don't have brothers and sisters. And Elise said, well, if you ask your parents, maybe they'll get you a sister. Mm. And, you know, suddenly all the gymnastics we went through, I think Elise absorbed something from Dun Dun that was much more telling than if we'd said it to her.
So heritage is important to you. You want your daughters to know their Chinese heritage.
Our daughters know they're Chinese, and yeah. we want to make that available to them.
But right. But you also want them to know your family's heritage and your wife's family's heritage. How important was heritage, family heritage, to you when you were growing up?
Well, you know, I can't. I'm the product of a mixed marriage, and that, in a funny way, was my heritage. I was aware of part of me being Jewish. I was aware of part of me being Irish Catholic. When my parents got married, that was considered a mixed marriage. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the 1950s, this was a reasonably controversial thing to do, and lots of people on both sides of the family weren't happy about it. And so I think I became aware of the fact that I was growing up in an ethnically and religiously mixed household. And in a funny way, that mixture became my heritage. And I find in life one of the things I treasure is that mixture of heritages as your own identity. It's why I love great cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and London. It's why I fell in love with Sarajevo and its mixed background and heritage. And I think it's one of the things that I hope our daughters are absorbing by being in a French family, an American family, Chinese heritage, Jewish influence, Chicago influence, all of that. I mean, they are culturally a mixed bag. And I find that attractive, and I think that's just the way we're living these days. And I think they're going to be more comfortable in the world that way. They'll make their own decisions about this because I think in the end, you know, the whole idea of getting your identity mixed up or dictated by your ethnicity seems to me not an attractive thing. And I have covered too many ethnic conflicts in too many parts of the world to think that deriving your identity from your ethnicity is a healthy or moral thing.
Scott Simon, it's great to talk with you. Congratulations on the book. Thank you so much for being with us on Fresh Air.
My pleasure, Terry.
Scott Simon is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. His new book is called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, In Praise of Adoption. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's not unusual to get in a cab and find a paperback novel on the seat next to the driver. What makes Jack Clark's cab different is that he's both the driver and the author. Clark is a 30-year-old Chicago cab driver who's written three books. The Washington Post called his mystery novel, Nobody's Angel, a gem that doesn't contain a wasted word or a false note. It's told in the voice of a Chicago cabbie named Eddie Miles and is as much about the life of taxi drivers as it is about the two serial murderers on the loose in the Windy City. Clark originally published the book himself under the title Relita's Angel and sold it for $5 a copy from his cab. It's now published by Hard Case Crime. Jack Clark wrote for the weekly paper The Chicago Reader years ago, but left journalism for the world of fiction writing and picking up fares. His story caught the eye of Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who once drove a cab in Philadelphia.
On Clark Street, a well-dressed black woman waved, then approached the cab. "Are you for hire?" she asked. "Come on," I said, and I reached back and opened the door. "What is wrong with you cab drivers, huh?" "Six cabs just passed me by." "Lady," I started. "Do I look like a criminal?" "Lady," I tried again. "Now you answer my question. Do I look like a criminal?" "Lady, if you look like a criminal, I wouldn't have picked you up. Now would you mind telling me where you're going?" "I'm going to the IC station," she said. "I live in the suburbs. I am not a criminal. I've never been a criminal. I do not associate with criminals. I have a good job. I pay my taxes. I go to church. But you cab drivers, all you can see is the color of my skin." "Lady, why are you giving me a hard time? I'm the guy who stopped."
Well, Jack Clark, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, it's nice to be here.
What do you like about driving a cab?
Well, I love driving. You know, at night, it's just kind of, you know, you just float around. Things happen. It's, you know, it's very relaxing if you don't let the traffic get you into. And if the people don't get you, and if you're not tired, and, you know, it's like playing jazz, I think, a little bit.
How's it like playing jazz?
Well, because you don't know where you're going until you know, you follow some path, and then you get somewhere you didn't know you were going to go.
And what hours do you typically drive?
Late afternoon to early morning, you know, 4 to 4, something like that. The bar is closed here at 4 in the morning in Chicago, so that's kind of the end of the night business.
You know, driving a cab is in some ways a unique job in that you're the only one in the workplace, and every transaction is an encounter with a stranger, somebody who could be friendly or could be mean or could be abusive or even a criminal. And I wonder if you have to carry yourself in a certain way, maybe kind of adopt a persona that's a little different than the Jack Clark we would know if we just saw you at a restaurant.
Oh, sure, you become a cab driver. You know, you become a little tougher, a little, you know, "Hey, buddy, blah, blah, blah," or "You can't do that in here," or, you know, but you're always looking at people to see who they are. But, you know, 99.9% of people are great. I've had a lot of great conversations with people in the cab, and, you know, I'm generally just want to get their money at the end of the ride and get them out of the cab so I can get another load, because I only have limited time. You know, I only drive a cab a couple of days a week, so I got to make the money.
And how did you learn to kind of adopt a cab driver's persona?
Oh, I think I did that right from the beginning, just so I could pretend to know what I was doing, you know, because you get in and you don't know what you're doing, and it's just, it's, you know, I think it's, I was telling a waitress recently, a new waitress, that she should do that. You know, just pretend you're an old waitress. Nobody will know the difference.
Do you worry as you get older that, I don't know, you won't have quite the reflexes and reactions that you did as a young driver?
Oh, yeah, certainly, especially with, you know, they put bulletproof shields in here, I would say, about 10 years ago. It's, you know, it's a half-open shield, but before that, there was a lot more attacks on cab drivers, a lot more guys jumping over the back seat at you and that kind of stuff. And it's a young man's game, but I couldn't foresee much of a future if they didn't have the bulletproofs, although I was against them when they put them in, but it has really calmed all that down.
Huh. What were some of the things that happened to you before they put them in?
Oh, you know, just people robbing, trying to. I only got robbed once, but I've had several guys attempt, you know, rob me. I had a guy jump over the back seat and grab me from behind and try to, you know, but I just jerked the cab forward and he kind of bounced back and I bounced him around a little bit. And that was a lot easier to do with before anti-lock brakes came in. You can't stop the cabs as quick as you used to. You used to be able to just boom, you know, and they go, and then you hit the gas, and you can't really do that anymore unless your anti-locks are broken.
So you'd use the cab, in effect, as a weapon to kind of throw him around the cab.
Right, and Eddie does that in the book, in one of the climatic scenes in the book. He uses the cab as that's how he gets control of this guy who's trying to rob him and is probably going to kill him.
So, right. It's a big moment in the book,
And it's a realistic scene because it used to. Yeah, if you knew what you were doing, you could just bounce a guy back and forth like a ping pong ball, and he couldn't do anything, and he'd beg you to let him out of the cab. You know.
There's a lot of discussion in the book about what fares you pick up and which ones you pass by, where you go and where you don't go. And in effect, cabbies, for their own safety, become profilers, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to figure out who somebody is. I mean, but that's, you know, half the time somebody gets in a cab, you know, if you know what you're doing, you know where they're going before they tell you. They're going to the Cubs game. You can tell how they dress. They're going to a bar in Lincoln Park. You can tell how they dress. You know, they're going home from a, you know, I mean, it's just, they're going to a gay bar. You know, they got the leather thing on. It used to be that transvestites would, you know, these women that were 6'4" with shoulders about as wide as a beer truck. And they'd get in the cab and it was Diversey and Clark. And you'd say, Cheeks? Because that was where all the transvestites hung out, at this little bar called Cheeks.
Do you think having to evaluate people all the time like that kind of gave you observational skills that informed your writing?
I don't know. I mean, I can maybe describe some of those things better. But, you know, I'm really only looking at the surface there. But I think driving a cab just helped me as a writer just because the different ways to get places. There's a million ways to get places. You know, you don't have to go the conventional way. You can use a lot of shortcuts. And I think that's really helped in my writing.
I remember one rule that I learned from one of the veteran cabbies after a woman. I'd taken her to a bar, and then she said she didn't have any money, so she was going to go inside to get it. And she just assumed I wouldn't follow her in because I was a white kid and it was an African-American neighborhood. But I went in, and she didn't have any money. And the thing that I remember the veteran cabbies told me after that experience was, never pick up a woman who isn't carrying a purse. Bad news.
Well, there's a lot of them that don't carry a purse, but I tell you, never get out of the cab. That's one of my rules for anything. You know, the cab is your little weapon. It's your security place. And $10 is, I'm not going into any bar. I had a guy run out of the cab one day on a $2 fare and run into a corner bar, and it was like, well, goodbye. You know, I'm not going into a bar for $2. We had a cab driver here killed a couple of years ago in a fare dispute where he got out of the cab to fight with the guy. And he left the engine running. So that's rule two. If you do get out of the cab, take the keys with you. And that's if you're pulling somebody out of the back seat, turn the engine off and take the keys with you. But he got right. The passenger ended up getting back in the cab and ran him over. I think he ran him over like 3 times. And then he claimed it was an accident. But he went to jail.
Were you a writer who became a cab driver or a cab driver who became a writer?
No, I was a writer first. My first published story was in 75. And I didn't start driving until either 77 or 78, I actually quit a staff job at the Chicago Reader and went to Flash Cab.
Right. Chicago Reader, it's a weekly, right?
Weekly alternate paper.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Did you think of yourself as a writer coming up, or, I don't know, did you train for something else?
No, I never went. I took one course at Columbia College. What happened to me is my dad gave me a copy of The Man with the Golden Arm, Nelson Algren's novel, when I was 16 years old. And I just loved the book. And I think before I was finished with the first page, I wanted to be a writer. That's how much I like the book. But I never really went to college. I took this story and journalism course at Columbia College here that was a great course. And I sold 2 stories out of the... I was going to take fiction courses at Columbia. I think I was 23 years old at the time. And all the fiction courses were filled up by the time I got there, so I took the story and journalism course. And so that's how I kind of accidentally got into journalism, because 2 of the stories I wrote for class I sold, or my teacher pretty much sold, one to the Reader, one to Chicago Magazine. So that got me into journalism. But I'm glad to be back out here in fiction.
Mm-hmm. So you left, and why did you go to drive a cab rather than sell insurance or take a computer course or something?
Well, I never wanted to do anything that I had to use my real brain at, you know, as a full-time job. I just wanted to – I was a furniture mover when I went to Flash Cab. When I went to the Reader, I was moving furniture and driving trucks. And that's what I drove over the road for about 15 years from like about 73 to 70 to 89 or something like that.
So when you say over the road, you mean driving a truck?
Yeah, I was a furniture mover for Allied Van Lines. I, you know, 48 states and just moving people around the country. And so that's I did that a lot. And then that was a summertime job. And then a cab I would do in the winter when the truck slowed down. And then in the 90s, I guess, I started doing the cab more as a steady source of income.
Now, you know, when you were a driver, as a driver, you're somebody who you certainly have skills and ambitions that probably a lot of drivers don't. I mean, do you feel different from a lot of the other drivers that you know out there?
Oh, no. I think, you know, nobody wants to be a cab driver. You know, they say you can never organize the cab drivers, and the reason you can never organize the cab drivers is nobody ever thinks they're going to do it for long. Because it's all just somewhere on the way somewhere else. You know, they're doing a lot of guys are going through school. A lot of these foreign drivers are well-educated, and they can't get a job in their field once they get over here. And then you start driving a cab, and if you work hard, you can make some decent money. But no, I think there's a lot of cab drivers that are. I've certainly met a lot of cab drivers that want to write.
Hmm.
You know.
Right. And then there are these the legends of the old-timers who did do it as a real profession back when you know, when cabbies wore uniforms and people in neighborhoods took cabs a lot more.
Yeah, I even then I knew guys that I use this thing in the book. The guy who says it's a story I put in Ace is an old veteran cab driver in the book, and I put the story in his mouth that I heard from a veteran cab driver at Flash, and it was like. He was talking about when they were going to pull his license, and he paid off a bunch of money so that, you know, which he used to be able to do here, to, you know, to the inspector so he wouldn't lose his license. And now he's wondering, you know, what he would have done with his life if he hadn't done that. You know, maybe he would have done something with his life, he says. All I've been doing is driving around in circles.
But he has stayed with it, right?
But he stayed with it, yeah. There were a lot of, you know, my friend, I have a friend who's a folk singer, Ed Holstein, and he said to me, he said, our parents just wanted jobs. We all want to be artists. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, my dad was a Depression kid. He was in World War II. He just wanted a job. He wanted to come back and have a job. And then, you know, as you get money in the middle class, you're a middle class kid, you want to be an artist and stuff like that. So I think the older drivers were more of that World War II generation. They just wanted a job and stability. Right. They didn't want to remember the Depression or the war.
Now, the book Nobody's Angel, you wrote this in the 1990s, and is it true you sold it in the cab?
Yeah, I wrote the first draft of this book about 1990, and then I kept trying to sell it, and I got a lot of good rejection letters, which do no good at all, and I was rewriting it all the time because somebody'd say this or somebody'd say that, or I'd get my hopes up that something could happen with it. And then I just got sick of it, so I decided if I self-published it, I could just get it out of my system, and I wouldn't have to keep rewriting the stupid thing. So that's what I did, and I found a place out in Nebraska, Moore's Publishing, which did a great job for about $1.86 a copy. And it's a really nice-looking book, Relita's Angel, and it was just 500 copies. So, you know, I sold them for $5 a piece, and I got my money back, and I made a little money on it. And right after I started selling the book in the cab, my sister, who's a professor out in Massachusetts, was at a party, and some woman finds out she's from Chicago, and she says, oh, my son just bought this most wonderful book from a cab driver in Chicago. And my sister says, could I see it? She goes upstairs and brings the book down. And, of course, it's my book. And my sister opens it and turns to the acknowledgement page where her name is, you know. So that was like immediately, like that was in a week or two after I started selling the book. It ended up in 1,000 miles away in Massachusetts.
What does the pitch sound like when I'm in your cab and you're offering me and you're selling your book?
Oh, no, I never pitched a book to anybody. I had a little basket, a book up on the dashboard. And then I had one hanging from a hook so it was facing you so you could see the cover. And if people asked about it, I would tell them. But I never offered to sell it to them unless they ask and I buy it. You know, nobody gets in a cab. They have somebody try to sell them a T-shirt or a book. I would never do that.
It's interesting that you drive at night. I mean, first time I drove a cab, I drove at night. And it got kind of creepy. And so I kind of stuck to days.
Well, see, I did the exact opposite. My first 3 days in a cab were daytime, and the traffic was so horrible, and I just couldn't take it. So I thought, I'd rather get shot in the head. And, you know, that was really I thought, I don't care. I can't do this anymore. And nights is so much better than days. I was on days just recently, a couple of years back, I was trying days again. And it's just, people are boring. They're not happy. They're going to work, and it's your fault. You know, I'm at work, too. Give me a break. But you can't get them to talk. They're just grumpy. You know, at night, people are having fun. They're leaving work, or they're having a drink, or they're going out to dinner. Or, you know, they're much more relaxed. Daytime, and the traffic is so horrible during the day. And the people at daytime, they know their way around more. They take this route to work. They know the shortcuts. You can't go down the side streets, and you cut through alleys. There's three cars cutting through the same alley because it's a shortcut to somewhere. Nighttime, you don't have that problem.
When people get in the cab, do you try and strike up conversations? Do you let them take?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. The great thing about the cab, it drives me crazy. All these guys who are on the phone, and I don't know if they do that in Philly, but in Chicago, half the cab drivers are on the phone. And they're just missing the best part of the job, I think, is you meet all these people, you talk to people, you find out stuff, you know, you hear about different countries, different cities, you know. You know, on an average night, I'll get maybe 30 fares in the cab. That's a lot of people in and out of your cab. They're great stories. You know, I've had a lot of fun with people. I've learned a lot of stuff in the cab. Don't ask me what any of it is, but, you know.
That never gets old, huh?
No, people are great. People are great. That's the truth.
Well, Jack Clark, thanks so much for speaking with us. It's been fun.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks. Nice talking to you.
Jack Clark spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Clark's latest book is called Nobody's Angel. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. This week marks the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's landfall. TV critic David Bianculli says that television was all over the story then and is all over it again now.
Whatever approach you'd like to see in a fifth anniversary update of Hurricane Katrina's impact on the Gulf region, TV provides it this week. A pure look back with retrospective clips and reflection? Check. Fresh reporting, digging up new angles and important stories? Check. A detailed update focusing not only on what happened then, but what has happened since? Check. All you have to do is know where to go. So here's a roadmap. Tonight at 9 Eastern Time on the National Geographic Channel, a two-hour special called Witness Katrina covers the August 2005 disaster from ground level. It collects images and recordings not from TV reporters on assignment, but from Gulf residents in their homes, holding camcorders or making phone calls as the massive storm surge comes closer and closer. Here are two such samples. First, from a woman filming as her house becomes a virtual island, then from another woman apologetically calling 911 for help a little too late. In both instances, what's so haunting is the calmness.
We are totally flooded. This is the bedroom. The bed is floating away, all the pillows, the cedar chest, everything floating away. I'm going to walk over here to the windows. I can't go outside anymore to take video, but if you can see out there, it is like we're in the middle of a river. We are totally surrounded by water. We've lost everything.
911, what's your emergency?
Hey, baby, we were stupid. We're down on the beach. In a solid house, I'm on the third floor. We're not sure what we should do, if we should try.
The only thing I can tell you to do is pretty much do what you got to do, because we can't get nobody to you right now.
Okay.
And we'll get somebody out there as soon as we can.
All right. Well, if worse comes to worse, my name is Ida.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell my family I love them.
On the other end of the spectrum, there's the raw emotion in this Wednesday's edition of the PBS series Frontline. Called Law and Disorder, it devotes itself to one specific incident amid all that chaos: the shooting of a young man and the severe beating endured by the man's brother when he went in search of medical help. Both the shooting and the beating, this investigative report concludes, were done by New Orleans police. At the end of the program, the surviving brother bursts into tears when discussing the cop who beat him. But he's crying not from rage, but from compassion.
I forgive that police officer. I forgive him with all my heart. Because if I don't, God ain't gonna forgive me when I do something wrong. I forgive him. And I'm trying to deal with this every day. It's hard, man. I feel like something just is gone. That I had in my heart is gone. I ain't gonna get it. I can't see him no more. Can't do the things we normally do. You know, I miss my brother. I miss him.
Then, for recaps and reflections of the TV coverage itself, there was NBC's Dateline special, which ran last night. Brian Williams, whose reports from New Orleans were some of the most impressive, discussed his memories of covering the flooded city streets, quite candidly, in a session taped shortly after the disaster itself.
We made a decision. The French Quarter was no longer safe. Things were getting too dicey, and we pulled out to the suburb of Metairie, Louisiana.
And good evening from Metairie, Louisiana.
I'll be candid. We heard CNN pull out. That had some influence on our decision. We had no weapons. We don't work that way. That has to separate us as journalists. But it wasn't safe. So here we are driving through town in our rental cars. State troopers had to cover us by aiming at the men in the street just to tell them, don't think of doing a smash and grab and killing this guy for the car.
5 years later, that really brings you back. Nothing does it quite so much, though, as the footage itself. Of the flooding, the people on rooftops holding signs for help, the bloated dead bodies floating in canals and even streets. The outrage that had happened here in the United States remains fresh. And in Spike Lee's new HBO documentary on the disaster and its aftermath, a follow-up to his earlier special, he includes several pieces of TV news that still sting. One is the infamous "doing a heck of a job, Brownie" remark by then-President George Bush. The other is CNN reporter Soledad O'Brien's interview with that very Brownie, Michael Brown, then the head of the FEMA Government Response Agency, whose response to O'Brien, 5 days after tragedy struck, leaves her incredulous.
FEMA's been on the ground for 4 days, going into the fifth day. Why no massive airdrop of food and water? In Banda Aceh, in Indonesia, they got a food drop 2 days after the tsunami struck.
We're feeding those people in the convention center. We have fed over 150,000 people as of last night. That is happening.
But I guess the point is, as of last night, sir, forgive me, I have to stop you here.
What we're hearing is that we're hearing people's frustration. There are people that are beginning to manifest themselves out of the community that we didn't know that were there.
Why are you discovering this now? It's 5 days that FEMA's been on the ground. The head of police says it's been 5 days that FEMA's been there. The mayor, the former mayor, putting out SOSs on Tuesday morning, crying on national television, saying, please send in some troops. So the idea that, yes, I understand that you're feeding people and trying to get in there now, but it's Friday. It's Friday.
Whether people want to believe
but it's not all bad news and rehash. That same Spike Lee documentary, which is called If God Is Willing and the Creek Don't Rise, and airs tonight and tomorrow night at 9 Eastern on HBO, covers new ground. Too much, actually, squeezing in both this year's Super Bowl win by the New Orleans Saints and the BP mega oil spill. But it also looks for signs of hope in the rebuilding of New Orleans and vicinity, and finds them, among other places, in the infamous Lower Ninth Ward, where actor Brad Pitt and his business partner, both heard here, have arranged for the design and construction of hundreds of new homes for low-income residents.
What you see here now is just under 50 houses either lived in or under construction. But it's more than that. We rejected the idea that affordable housing has to, you know, use crap materials, toxic materials, and appliances that run up a family's utility bills.
As you can see here, we've put solar panels on all the houses, and these panels on a day like today provide enough electricity to run the entire house. So this house is feeding electricity back to the grid, which makes the electricity bills next to nothing.
They are safe because we don't know. We don't know about this wall here. We know it's safer. We got to make sure that these homes are going to be here if something like that were to happen again.
The point of all these TV specials is clear. We shouldn't forget what happened 5 years ago. And TV, more than any other medium, brings it back the most vividly, the way we first experienced it.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com, and he teaches TV and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.